Alright, well, the first thing to say is I've had a very nice time here in KITP, so thank you to Ilya and the rest of the organisers for inviting me along. I've had a great time, and thank you all for coming to listen to this talk. This is some work which I did with John in Oxford as part of my PhD thesis work, so I'm going to take you through that calculation this morning. And the rough outline goes as follows. So first I'll say what it is we're interested in and why we're interested in it. The subject of the talk is self-avoiding loops. And so I'm going to start with a review of how we get to this loop gas picture from the ON model, which is probably familiar to most, but I just to get us started. Then I'll introduce these twist operators and show that their correlation functions can help tell us something about the geometry of these self-avoiding loops. Finally, because we're at an SLE gathering, I thought I'd just point out that there's an underlying stochastic process behind all of this and just paint that picture for you. So what is this all about? So last year, a recent Fields Medal winner showed that there's this measure on simple loops on any Riemann surface which has this conformal restriction property. So that's very similar to the conformal restriction property of kappa equals 8/3 for SLE. So we were interested in asking questions about this measure on conformally invariant loops. In particular, we just noticed that for a given loop, a domain is split into two subdomains. So you have the two domains separated by the boundaries of this loop. So we could ask questions like, given a pair of points on the Riemann sphere, we can think of the subset of loops which separate them into the two different subdomains. So what is the measure on these types of loops? That's our first question. The second question we asked is, well, how can we generalize this idea to more than two points? So if we had four points, we could consider the loops which separate them into pairs, or have one point on one subdomain and the other three separated from them. So those are the sorts of questions we're interested in. And what I'm going to talk about today is how we can use methods of conformal field theory to answer some of these questions. So this is the partition function for the ON model. These S's are end component spins living on a lattice, which we'll take to be the triangular lattice for simplicity. The spins are going to live on the honeycomb lattice. So these products is over all pairs of nearest neighbor spins, and this X is just some parameter which is simply related to the temperature of the model. So how to go from here to a loop picture is a fairly standard step to take. All you do is expand out this product, getting a 2 to the n terms where n is the number of nearest neighbors, and take then the trace over the spins. And you see that this partition function is the same as a partition function where the sum now is over graphs on the edges of the original lattice. These are non-intersecting loops which are closed. Any open loops just vanish over taking trace over spins. So this is the partition function we're going to be using today. This V here is just the number of loops for a given state, and L is the total length of loops. So this picture would have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, so x to the power 10, and just a single factor of n. Okay, so the observation is that single self-avoiding loops are just the order n to the 1 term in this expansion, having only one loop and having a weight which is dependent only on their length. So this is the set of loops we expect to have this restriction property. And the observation is that if the scaling limit exists of these self-avoiding loops, this is what we would expect to describe the measure on loops which have this conformal restriction property in Werner's measure. Okay. So if we want a field theory for this, we have to take these non-local factors of n and make them local. And the way we do this is by assigning orientations arbitrarily to these loops and summing over these orientations with complex turning weights at each vertex. So say e to the plus I chi where the loop turns to the right, e to the minus where it turns to the left. Therefore, you'll see that each closed loop will be weighted by either e to the 6i chi if it's clockwise, or minus 6i chi if it's anti-clockwise. So we just choose chi carefully so that we recover this factor of n we want. Yeah?
Choose one from letters. Is something special about it?
Yes, right, okay. So this is just convenient because in this picture, you can have only 0, 1, 2, or 3 edges coming into a given vertex site. So it just makes the trace over spins straightforward, and you don't have to worry about, for example, 4 edges coming into the square lattice. You have problems deciding how to treat such vertices. This is just a convenience. Okay, so now we have this picture of oriented loops. We know that you can map this to a height model. So if I cross a loop running from left to right, I decrease my height by some factor, usually traditionally taken to be pi. So these heights are now living on the dual lattice, and this height model is just conjectured to flow at its critical point under the renormalization group to some simple Gaussian free field. But this g is just some simple function of chi. It's not important for what I want to say. So this is just a set of heights living. So if you have a, it's just a step model. These heights are just simple variables living on the dual lattice. Not only that the increments are pi. You then, well, if you have arbitrary many loops, but you have to pick a starting value somewhere, so it's not unique up to this choice of starting height, but that's the only freedom you have left. Okay, so that's all fairly standard, but we haven't quite solved our problem because we have to take into account still some topological subtleties. So imagine, for example, we have this theory on the cylinder. If I have a loop wrapping around this cylinder, it has the same number of left turns as right turns. So we failed to count it with the weights we wanted. Remember that we said a clockwise loop would have e to the 6i chi and vice versa. Well, these have got a factor of 1 for each orientation. So when I sum over orientations, unless n equals 2, I'm going to get the wrong factor here. Okay, so what I have to do is insert charges at either end of the cylinder, and let's just see how that solves our problems. So if I have a single loop here, then the height at one side of it is going to be pi greater or less than the height at the other end, depending on the direction of the loop, so that when I sum over both directions, I indeed just pick up the correct factors that I'm after. And this prescription solves the problem of any numbers of loops wrapping around the cylinder. You can show that quite straightforwardly. Okay, so this actually changes the partition function of our model. So the partition function in the presence of these operators at the end now is an expectation value of this pair of charges at the end in some free field multiplied by the free field partition function. And thankfully, these things are very straightforward to calculate because these are just correlation functions with respect to this Gaussian action. So we can do this calculation and show that this partition function takes the following form. And indeed, from considering the free energy, therefore, of this model, which is just, as usual, the free energy per unit length here, we see that we have the expected form for a theory on the cylinder with some central charge C given by this familiar form. Right. Okay. So that's the first part in the outline of the talk. That's just a bit of background for you. So now I'd like to introduce... Sorry.
The argument to say that discreteness is not orthogonal, and
so this is rather subtle, and I'm not sure I could answer that question even given more time, so perhaps at the end we can come back to it.
But the point is that discreteness is marginal.
Well, this is how you pick your value of g of chi, essentially.
Can you say very big experience. The beautiful relation of seedless and love.
Well, that sounds interesting, but it's not what I want to dwell on for what we're particularly interested in. But yeah. Well, that would be interesting, because that would have also an interpretation for a lot of what I'm going to go on today. So that would be interesting.
But you can formulate it on the torus or the endless. There's no overture, and all of this thing still holds. So.
But in general, what he adds to the action to get this perturbation away from people's one government.
Well, absolutely not, because on the torus there's no scalar curvature, and it's still there. These effects are still there. I think this is a wrong statement in the literature, but I think.
Okay.
Go on. But it has anything to do with the scalar. Well, it does have something to do with it, but you can still do the Coulomb gas.
Then they talk about pluses.
Yeah, there's a plus is going for the cycle on the torus.
All right, well, perhaps we can return to this discussion after some further comments that I have to make, because I think you might find that interesting. So, did you want to?
Would you be so kind to repeat the argument why you have to put this charge at the
Sure, end? Sure. Okay, so the argument was simply that these complex turning weights were introduced such that when I sum over orientations, I get the right factor. But if I have loops wrapping around the cylinder, these have the same number of left and right turns. So they don't satisfy this idea that a clockwise loop has six more right turns than left turns. You could have a loop wrapping around the cylinder with the same number of left and right turns. So they're not counted correctly. That's the reason for requiring these vertex charges at the ends. All right, so what else could we do with this picture? So we introduced these charges at the ends to take account of the loops wrapping around the cylinder and count them in the same way as the loops we had which didn't wrap around. But we could imagine counting these loops differently. So what if we count loops with some weight n prime different to n, wrapping around a certain portion of the cylinder, and that would correspond to an insertion of a different set of different pair of vertex operators with some chi primes here rather than chi. Well, in that case, the partition function is again free field expectation values, and we can determine the scaling dimension of these operators straightforwardly. So I just want to talk about one particular choice of n primed today, and this particular choice is of interest for two reasons. The first is that if I choose n prime to just be minus n, what that's saying is each loop which separates my two points is counted in the same way but with an additional factor of minus one. Okay, so I can picture this idea as a defect line running between these two charges, and this two-point expectation value will just count minus one to the power of the number of crossings. All right, now that's useful to us because this defect line can be deformed in any way. So let me just show you a picture here. If I have an odd number of loops separating the two points, then minus one to the power of the number of crossings will be minus one for any path of this defect line I choose. Similarly, if there's an even number of loops separating the two points, then I have a weight 1. So clearly these defect lines can take any path I want. And the second most important reason for considering this case n primed equals minus n is that the scaling dimension of the vertex operators with that choice precisely correspond to that of phi 1-2 operators. So these have level 2 null states, and their correlation functions satisfy partial differential equations of the Belevin Poilier type.
Right? It's all happening in the bulk.
Yeah, sure.
The whole bulk operator.
Sure. Yeah. So these are just, when you talk about correlation functions of these operators, you can just talk about your correlation functions of bulk phi 1-2 operators. So we have these two separate pictures now. We have this loop gas formulation where these insertion of a pair of operators gives me the expectation value of minus 1 to the number of crossings of defect lines, as I can also calculate these two-point functions exactly using scale invariance. So I have these two pictures that I can equate here and hope to say something about the loops.
Are these null operators that
they have conformals? No, they're spinless. They're just phi 1-2 operators.
Sorry, homomorphic and anti-homomorphic dimensions, are the same?
Yeah, exactly. So this G is this function that comes into the action, which I didn't really want to discuss. It's just some simple function of n or chi. The point is that it's the same scaling dimension, and that's what we're going to use. So let's, since we're interested in self-avoiding loops, which recall were the order n to the 1 terms in the loop gas expansion, let's expand these two sides to order n to the 1 and see what we get. So on the left-hand side, recall my partition function was x to the power of the length multiplied by n to the power of number of loops. So the graphs with zero loops just contribute this factor of 1 here. And these are, I've split this sum into two sums with just one loop. This first sum is the sum over all loops which separate the points Z1 and Z2. So these come weighted with this additional factor of minus 1. And this second part of the sum with single loops is just over all loops which leave Z1 and Z2 in the same subdomain. So these don't have a factor of minus 1. This denominator is just the partition function. Right? So these don't have any factor of minus 1. So there are higher order terms, are two loops, three loops, etc. But we're down just going to equate powers of n to the 1 here. So the right-hand side is simple to Taylor expand in n. And we equate these two sides in the following way. We just match the powers n to the 1. So expanding this, we have minus 1 here over the sum of all loops separating 1 and 2. The right-hand side, I have some logarithm. So I can set these two equal, and we have the answer to our first question in the motivation part, which is just that.
Did you have to know the dependence of G on N to do that? The couple.
Yeah. So this is what I've used. So, but I just want to hide that from you for the purposes of this talk. It's just that it has some simple function of N, and we Taylor expand that. Okay. The point is that these scaling dimensions here vanish as N goes to 0. So this is the reason for the appearance of these logarithms here. So the answer to our first question then is that the sum over all loops which separate the two points as a function of Z1 and Z2 just takes this form. So clearly, as I shrink this lattice constant A, this number is diverging. And that, the reason for that is simple. It's just that there's no cutoff as the lattice goes to 0. So I have contributions from vanishingly small limits, vanishingly small loops around both of the points in this limit. And these are just a diverging contribution. Okay, so the next question was, how can we generalize this? And the way we...
This is not quite the number of loops, right?
This is the weighted number of loops. Right, so this is a sum for all loops of that subset weighted by xc to their length. Right. So these are self-avoiding loops. Okay, so the way we generalize this is to consider the four-point correlation function. So now we have four points on our Riemann sphere, which I've just labelled here. It's not very clear, I'm sorry about that. But the picture now is of a pair of defect lines running between two and two operators. So this sort of picture I have in caption A here. It's not important which way I choose my pairs, and the argument for that is simply that, recall, I can deform these defect lines any way I like. So in particular, I can deform them to look like the defect lines in caption B here, and any loop crossing a pair of defect lines contributes minus 1 squared. So it's the identity, and a pair of defect lines essentially is the same as having no defect lines at all. So in this way, I've shown that choosing your pair of defect lines running in this fashion is equivalent to having them run between different pairs of operators. And there's a similar argument, obviously, for running from 1 to 4 and 3 to 2. So you can pick these any way you like. And this four-point function just measures minus 1 to the power of the total number of crossings of both defect lines. So we have a similar sort of idea as before how to proceed here. We're going to find this function in conformal field theory and expand both sides of this expression in powers of n, equating n to the 1 to look at single self-avoiding loops. So this time, things are a little bit more complicated. Rather than just having loops which separate two points or put them in the same subdomain, we have 8 different topologically distinct subsets. So I can have loops which separate one point from the other three, and there are 4 ways of doing that. The 3 ways of having them separated pairwise, or you could consider loops which surround all 4. So that's what I've tried to just show here. So this loop gas picture has a sum over loops. This is a loop set of loops which separate points 1, 2, 4 from point 3. So I hope the notation is reasonably clear. And this W, as Ilya was keen to point out, is the sum of loops which is weighted by this factor x e to their length. That's important. Okay, so the right-hand side is a little bit more complicated than before again, but these four-point correlation functions satisfy this set of BPZ equations and have solutions in terms of hypergeometric functions with some parameters which need determining by boundary conditions. Right. But okay, so the differential equation, yeah, so it's an ODE in terms of the cross ratio. The way you get to that ODE, though, is just through considering the null states. So it's a PDE in terms of the variable Z. Okay, so you're right. So we expect the answer just to depend on the cross ratios. We'll see that. So the boundary conditions we choose is that this should be symmetric under interchange permutations of these labels. We chose them arbitrarily, and that determines one of the constants, and the other constant is just a choice of normalization of the fields or the operators in this picture. Okay, so what we have to do here to get to particular combinations of loops we're interested in is take partly disconnected four-point functions. So this full four-point function here was a sum over all sorts of different topological sets of loops. Similarly, these C12s, these are just a two-point function of Z1 and Z2, have an interpretation of the loop gas picture in terms of sums over these subsets. So if I choose this particular combination here, then I end up with just the subset corresponding to loops separating 1-3 from 2-4, for example. If you wanted 1-2 and 3-4, you'd just change where this minus sign is.
So W is simple graphical interpretation, right?
Any
W that appears on your...
So W was here, yeah.
W's have simple graphical interpretation,
okay? Right, well, it's the sum over all loops which separate these points.
The but the correlation functions do not. They somehow get the divisions from A.
Well, the correlate... So this four-point function is getting contributions from 4 different types of loops. These two-point correlation functions get contributions from different sets of groups, and I could write this out explicitly for you. It's a little bit tedious, but so this C12.
Look. C12 involves two loops, right?
No.
One loop separating two points. C34 also involves one loop separating two points. At 2 points, three and four, right? Or sometimes in one of the configurations. Somehow two loops are present in this guy.
Okay, so the confusion here is just that you're taking your Taylor expansion separately and not combining them in the right way. But so this is the two-point function of 1, 2 is just one from the no-loop contribution plus an order n term from the one-loop contribution. Similarly here, so when I take the product of these things, I just take order n. I still only have one-loop contributions. So this C12 will get contributions from a different set of the W. So if I take the correct combination, then I end up with a particular choice that I'm after. So why have I chosen this particular choice? The reason this is interesting is that loops contributing to W1324 like this have some natural smallest length, right? Because if I have a loop which is going to separate points 1, 3 from 2, 4 in the continuum limit, the smallest such loop that I can have which achieves this wraps around both points rather than just shrinking to zero as we had in the two-point case. So we might hope that this has some limit in the scaling limit, which indeed it does. So this is the particular form this function takes, this sum over weighted loops. You see that we have some hypergeometric functions and some generalized hypergeometric functions, but the key, as Ilya pointed out, is that this is just a function of these cross ratios here and the anti-holomorphic cross ratio, which is just put bars everywhere.
So what is the order of the differential equation that you're solving in the end?
Okay, so when you solve the differential equation for the four-point function, you just get hypergeometric functions. When I take an order n to the 1 term in its expansion, I'm effectively taking the derivative with respect to n at n equals 0. So this just turns out to be nicely given in terms of these generalized hypergeometric functions. Right. Okay, so that's probably best seen in terms of this formula for the cross ratio. So we have poles 0, 1, and infinity. Right. So 0 is when either of these points come together. 1 would be when 2 and 3 come together. So this is just that this thing, this expression diverges when we take pairs of points close together. So 1 is when the points 2 and 3 come together in this expression, for example. Okay. So the nice thing to notice here is as I take the continuum limit, this lattice spacing going to 0, this number is finite. There's no A dependence in this formula. So this, for any theory that the mathematicians formulate for these self-avoiding loops, hopefully should verify this prediction in the continuum.
Okay. I mean, it's worth saying that as eta goes to 1, so those 2 points pinch the loop, right?
Right, okay.
And then the power that you get is related to the fractal dimension of the curve.
Right. Thanks, yeah, okay. So as I pinch pairs of... So as I pinch these pairs of points together, I'm forcing the loop to go through a smaller and smaller gap here, essentially. So I'm forcing the path of this loop to travel between 2 points. Why does this give us... Could you ask your question? Okay.
Fractal dimension of the curve.
Yeah, but whether it's the same as the fractal dimension in terms of the number of disks you need to cover the loop.
When you fuse to this of this topper, you get psi 0, 1.
So when I fuse this pair of operators, which are phi 1, 2.
Psi 0, 1 is definitely related to the fractal dimension, that I know. It's just
just the...
Well, I mean, the fusion rule, when I fuse my 512 operators in the bulk, I get an identity operator and a 513 operator.
Yeah, that's right.
So...
Identical zero, that's the same as what we're talking about.
Okay.
Right. Okay. That's right.
The left-hand side, you have to start the length to separate one from three, or to separate one, two, three, four. But of course, that length is one on the
Well, so the answer to this, I'm guessing, is that then you have to think about the number of loops, not just... So you have some set of loops which, on the lattice, this is an easier question to answer, I think, than in the continuum. So on the lattice, you have a certain number of loops which separate two points, and if I move those points further apart, I have more loops which separate those two points. So even though this diminishes this factor xe to the l, I have more loops contributing to the sum. So you can imagine that this thing could be conformally invariant for that reason. When I fuse these two operators, then I'm saying that I have a identity and an energy operator in terms of conformal field theory, and that presumably the factor dimension of the curve is related in the n goes to zero limit to one of these operators. I think that's the claim. I'm not sure which or how. Perhaps we could have a discussion about that.
The energy operator.
So the energy operator is telling us about the factor dimension. Okay. Yeah, so it's a useful check. Yeah, okay. Okay, so we've just got time to address this last part, which is how this is all of this is related to an SLE process. This is just a conjecture, so this is something the mathematicians could well shoot me down in flames here. Okay, so we know that the four-point correlation function satisfies the set of differential equations. That's how we got our solution to the four-point function. So therefore, given that this weighted number of loops is just the four-point function with some disconnected pieces, it also satisfies a set of partial differential equations. In particular, for this choice, we see this inhomogeneous equation. So there's also a similar anti-holomorphic equation. If we change variables to this W tilde, which has these pieces to remove the inhomogeneous part, and just take the sum of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic equations, I arrive at this partial differential equation for W tilde. So this is the Laplacian operator here, and this will be familiar to people who've been working in SLE. Where's my...
What's X1? What's the delta? Do you have second derivative with respect to x1, which is what?
That's just the x1 is just, I'm calling x my real part and y my imaginary part.
And w tilde is a linear combination of the sum of
the... W tilde was the particular choice which...
It's purely holomorphic, right?
No.
He's added the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic equations together.
So this is some real part here. So I have some...
Oh, that looks like twice both. Okay.
Okay. So I seem to have just... Oh, no, I put them back. Okay, so this was my differential equation that this W tilde satisfies. And just a little bit of background here.
So you made homogeneous only one of these equations by this subtraction.
So how I've arrived here is I've taken a particular linear combination of the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic equations.
If you go back to the bottom line, I think you have to there's a real part in that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this makes both Z and Z bar equations homogeneous?
Yes, precisely.
And where is the right-hand side coming from on the next page?
So, the right... Let me go back to my... Okay. If I add... So the right-hand side is just coming from the sum of this and its anti-holomorphic part. So the sum of the derivative of Z1 squared and the anti-holomorphic part gives me the Laplacian operator and the real part. Okay. So if I have... Okay, so a little bit of background here for those who don't know quite so much SLE. Just that if I have some sequence of conformal maps which satisfy this equation, then this describes an SLE growing in the upper half plane from the imaginary part of Z equaling the imaginary part of Z1. So I'll have a picture to help here. Here's a picture. So here's my four points, and I have some growth process starting from this point Z1 going into the reflected growth process going up into the upper half plane. So if I have such a process, then a martingale in this process would satisfy an equation just like this, but with the right-hand side equal to zero, and this term in general being kappa over 2. So we see we've got some kappa equals 6 process going on here, and the right-hand side is telling us precisely how W tilde fails to be a martingale. And so maybe I should explain briefly why we expect W tilde not to be a martingale, and how this particular form for the way in which it fails to be a martingale is reasonable. So, okay, so this process, kappa equals 6 process, touches itself on the real axis almost...
Z1 will always be real now?
No, Z1 is some complex number. So you could always just think of some translation taking Z1 down to the real axis, if you like.
So on the previous page, there was Z1 sub t.
Yeah.
This is a fixed complex number plus a real rounded motion, or was it
very... Right. It's just take your SLE and just move it. Okay. So when this curve, this kappa equals 6 curve, touches itself, which it does almost surely in finite time, then this hull, this interior region, is mapped to a point by these transformations. Okay? So any loops which were enclosed in this interior point at that time are mapped to a point and disappear out of our set of loops. So what this right-hand side is telling us is that after some time, these loops are being swallowed by this process, and the rate at which they're being swallowed is precisely given by the Laplacian. So let me just briefly say something about why that Laplacian deserves to be there. Remember that the Laplacian on the discrete lattice is just the sum of differences in the value of a function over the nearest neighbours. So if you're on the square lattice, it's 4 times the value here, subtract off all the neighbours. And recall also that these loops are marking differences in heights of variables. So if the Laplacian vanishes, that says that the values of the function is the same over all the nearest neighbour points, so therefore I don't have any loops. So this is just a reasonable, this is just a brief explanation for why we'd expect the Laplacian to be the right thing to tell us how the loops are vanishing. And one just final point before I finish and summarise is that you can also play this game in any simply connected domain, because these can be mapped to the upper half plane, and the 2-point functions in the upper half plane are simply related to the 4-point functions in the bulk. So you get an expression for the number of loops wrapping around 2 points in the upper half plane in this way. All right, so what have we been talking about? Hopefully you'll have heard that the ON model can be thought of as a loop model, and that self-avoiding loops are some limit of this model. We've talked about twist operators and how correlation functions of these operators tell us something about the geometry of these loops. And finally, just a brief suggestion of how this could be related to some stochastic process. I'm not saying that what we've done here is the most sensible way of proceeding, because clearly we have a symmetry which we've broken arbitrarily by choosing to put this line from Z1 plus some real numbers and reflect it. Maybe we'd be better, we'd preserve the symmetry better if we instead thought of some process in the full plane or radial SLE or something. It doesn't seem the most sensible way to proceed, but anyhow, I hope it's given some interest to those who are interested in SLE. You can ask questions, more general questions. So you can ask questions like, what if I think about two loops? You know, if I take the n squared term, in general, this partition function contains all numbers of loops. So if I just isolate the two loop case, what can I say about that? The trouble is, when you have two loops, you have a proliferation of different topological subsets, and you can't just isolate a given pair of loops in the same way as we did for a single loop around four points. It's very messy.
You might mention what these correlation functions correspond to for the Ising model, for example.
Yeah, okay. So perhaps I could put the lights on the blackboard if you want to say something about that. So in the Ising model, these loops, so if I just think about the two-point function, I can think of an Ising model on the dual lattice and these loops just behaving as cluster boundaries, because the expectation value of -1 to the number of loops in that case is just oscillating between plus and minus spins each time I cross a boundary. So this is just giving me the spin-spin correlation function. And there's a similar interpretation for the four-point function. So that's just relating it briefly to the Ising model as well. All right.
How bring a bell and